I've been driving all night, my hands wet on the wheel. There's a voice in my head that drives my heel.
We're glad you're here. Weather radar. It's an important tool that's a lifesaver when severe storms, tornadoes, or hurricanes threaten. But are there limitations to its effectiveness? That's one of the top issues this week on Jet Streaming, the podcast that's all about the weather. I'm Kathy Werzer. Glad you could join us again for Jet Streaming. With us, meteorologist Craig Edwards and climatologist Mark Seely. Radar Love. Now, who would have thought, huh? On the archives comes a song like that.
Only a meteorologist.
Huh? Would love it.
Sounds
love
like
it.
A bit of a stretch to me.
Well, okay. All right. We're going to delve into a couple of topics today. One is fire weather. Tinder dry conditions around the country have ignited huge fires in Georgia, California, Florida, and Minnesota. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But I want to begin by talking about something, gentlemen, that we initially touched on last week. It was the Greensburg, Kansas tornado, that EF5 twister that literally blew away most of the town. We were talking about the lead time that residents received before the tornado hit, which was a Friday night, I think, Craig.
Yeah.
Wasn't that about, what, 15, 20 minutes lead time?
I think, Kathy, that I've heard as much as 30 minutes of lead time for the city itself. Yeah. Now, the first place it got hit may have only had about 10 minutes. So remember, the storm was on the ground further west of Greensburg.
Well, National Weather Service uses NEXRAD Doppler radar, and it's a technology that our next guest knows a whole lot about. In the 1970s, Don Burgess and a team of researchers looked at the warning and forecast applications of Doppler radar, and that research found that Doppler could see mesocyclone and tornado signatures sometimes 20 to 30 minutes before the tornadoes formed. And those results helped launch the government's NEXRAD system. And now Don is a consultant working on the next generation of radar enhancement. He's actually working on an experiment today, but he's kind enough to sneak away and join us for a few minutes. Don, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine.
Oh, have you had a chance to take a peek at the radar imagery from Greensburg?
Yes, I have.
What'd you learn?
Well, we learned that it was a very strong mesocyclone, strong rotation. It was cyclic. It produced a number of tornadoes in sequence. In those ways, it was like many other supercells, the most severe and the worst ones that occur. The environment was portentous, and we had this very significant storm. There was actually a significant storm slightly earlier in northwest Oklahoma near Arnett, and we took some mobile radars up there and collected some data on that storm a little earlier in the evening, but we did not chase or get any good data up close and personal on the Greensburg storm.
How far away from the Dodge City radar was that storm when it was indicating the capabilities of producing a tornado? We know that the beam width changes the farther you get away from the radar.
Mm-hmm.
The forecaster watching the radar, I'm sure he had a good look at that. And when you get a mesocyclone rotating like that, the confidence level goes up for a storm like that. How far from the radar was that storm?
It was less than 50 miles from the radar during quite a bit of its development. The storm that became the Greensburg storm actually formed on the right flank of a left-moving storm that had come from the Oklahoma storm. And it organized right on the Oklahoma-Kansas border and then moved northeast or east-northeast. And it went from about 30 to 40 miles from the Dodge City radar to about 60 miles from the radar during this time period we're talking about.
Say, Don, Mark Seely here. I had a more generic question for you, but one that you'd probably be adept at answering for us. The use of Doppler radar, and we hear a lot about scatter and noise in the radar signals. Are there landscapes in the U.S. where the Doppler is absolutely most effective, and then there's others because of local terrain where it's really quite limited?
Yes, that's correct. Our network was designed for good radar coverage in those areas of the United States that don't have complex terrain. And when I say complex terrain, I mean big mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So east of the Rocky Mountains, we have good coverage. In and to the west of the Rocky Mountains, all the way to the West Coast. Our coverage has gaps because of that high terrain, and it just wasn't felt by the people who made the decisions that it was cost effective to add so many extra radars to get good coverage everywhere in the West.
Craig Edwards again. When the Doppler's been out for about 10 years, there was a learning curve for meteorologists to capture what they were looking at and what all they were seeing on radar. And I think initially there was we started seeing thunderstorms with such intensity, we were jumping all these warnings. And over the course of the 10 years, the Weather Service has had like a 70% even higher false alarm rate on identifying tornado signatures that actually produce a tornado on the ground. How does the Weather Service lower that, and how do they? What's the next generation of radar going to do to improve that that false alarm ratio?
Well, the high false alarm ratio is one of our problems, Craig. As you well know, we've talked about it before in a number of settings. The situation that we have with our current network is associated with an asymmetric penalty function, or that's what I call it. There is a lot of penalty for missing an event. Nobody in the system wants that to occur. There's less penalty for going ahead and issuing a warning, better safe than sorry. But all of those warnings add up and give us a high false alarm ratio. So with our current system and with the limitations of sampling and all the other things that occur, and the fact that there's big tornadoes and little tornadoes, we do much better with the big tornadoes and more poorly with the little ones, we've kind of fallen into this system where we're living with a high false alarm ratio. And bringing the false alarm ratio down right now is going to require allowing for more misses. And at the moment, the system doesn't seem to want to tolerate that. For the future, there are some things that we can do.
For instance,
we need to have more radars, and I'm not talking about in the mountainous West where the coverage is more poor. I'm talking about all over the country. We need to have more radars. We need to have boundary layer radars in addition to the NextRad type radars. These boundary layer radars are less expensive, but there are more of them, and we can get more data closer to the ground. With any radar, one of the limitations is the radar horizon. The radar beam does not bend at the same rate that the Earth curves. So the further away from the radar you get, the higher off the ground are the radar observations. So because of that, we need more radars, and we have some research underway to try and develop what's called cheap boundary layer radars, and the goal is perhaps to have a radar on every cell phone tower in the country.
Don, we probably don't like to call them cheap. We just like to call them efficient. But when I was...
not very much cost.
When I was phasing in the restructuring of the Weather Service here in Minnesota in the mid-90s, one of the concerns by our constituents, particularly the politicians, was the radar coverage along the Canadian border and the lack of no radar at International Falls and the fact that there was a gap around Alexandria. And the whole question then was, well, we're not degrading services. We're still having good radar coverage. We don't have the best, but we got the best that our tax dollars will buy. And for years, I sort of had to remain quiet on this political issue of more radars are needed in Minnesota. And now you're talking about the desire to get more radars or the need to get more radars. How are these radars going to be funded?
Well, it's not decided. So I can only talk about possibilities and what's been discussed. Mm-hmm. But there are no official programs. So please understand that my thoughts at the moment are just a few among other possibilities, of course, biased by what I think. I believe that there will be a program for the future, but right now everything is under development. But the ideas of which I am aware suggest that we need to have a public-private partnership to fund these radars. The communications, the cell phone industry, the communications industry is interested. I told you we have already some activity, some research work in Oklahoma, a program called CASA, Center for Adaptive Sensing of the Atmosphere. And we have some of these radars. And we have interest from the private sector in becoming a partner. And I think in the future we'll see that partnership grow And that's how we will be able to afford having so many radars.
You know, Don, can I go back to, you mentioned the really big tornadoes like Greensburg, and you mentioned the little guys, the F-0, the F-1 tornadoes.
Right, of which there are many more.
Exactly, exactly. So how effective is Doppler for identifying the circulation of those smaller tornadoes?
Well, sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. Of course, that's the way with most things in life. You can have a strong mesocyclone circulation up in the cloud, and that's what Doppler detects best, and still have it produce only a weak tornado because of certain things that might happen. Maybe too much cold air outflow is surging out from the downdraft or other things that prevent a strong tornado from forming. So our strong mesocyclones can produce weak tornadoes. That's how we get some of the weak tornadoes. But other weak tornadoes come from non-supercell processes. They come from tornadoes that form along the leading edge of squall lines, along the gust fronts of squall lines. We have tornadoes that come from waterspouts along the coastal areas. Even our inland lakes can have waterspout-type tornado formation. So we have a number of mechanisms that produce tornadoes that are the really weak and small and ephemeral circulations, and those are the ones that our current generation of Doppler radars do the poorest on.
What about three-dimensional radar displays for identifying those smaller tornadoes? Would that be helpful?
Well, I think three-dimensional radar displays in general are a good idea, and we're doing research work on that here in Norman, and it's being done in other places. But the problem really is the basic sensing, the basic observation. If the whole circulation is only a mile in diameter, and if our beam width is a mile across, it still doesn't help. So three-dimensional or not, it is the scale of the observation that's the most important. So what I favor are really two things for the future. One is higher resolution observations, more data near the ground, more radar data. And then second, what I favor is the development of these storm scale numerical models. And if we can get those to work right and develop them, they don't do it now, but if we can get them to develop for the future, then we can add a forecast component to these things and not just always be relying on detection.
Don, one of the things you and I talked about a while back is the Weather Service operation exclusively with the NEXRAD radar, and if the NEXRAD goes out, they've got to default to the backup, the closest Weather Service office radar. We talked about the large metropolitan areas. The TV stations have their own Doppler radar, and they have their own Doppler software. And one of the things you talked about when you were up here several years ago is, and you mentioned it today so far, is this partnership. Where do you see a partnership going with the Weather Service having access to metropolitan Doppler radar TV stations and their software to capture some of this imagery that the TV stations are showing?
Well, we've made some slight progress, Craig. I would say only slight. Let me diverge from answering that to say one more thing that contributes here, and that is there are some other radars in various areas around big cities. There are the terminal Doppler weather radars that are funded by the FAA, and we are making great progress in getting Weather Service office access to all the terminal Doppler weather radars. But now going back to the TV station radars, I'd say we're only making slight progress because it's a difficult partnership to have.
Too competitive, maybe, Don?
There is a competitive component, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a prototype program in the San Francisco area where the Weather Service is getting access to and getting a sharing of two television station radars. And it helps in the coverage for the San Francisco Bay metropolitan area. And that data is going in and actually being displayed on AWIPS through some experimental software that's been developed. So I point to that as a good example. And I know other places in the country where Weather Service offices do work with TV stations, and maybe the TV station radar is available to look at on a website. Or here in Oklahoma, the television stations have a lot of coverage. They break in often and show things. And actually, the Weather Service just monitors the television stations to get some access to those data that way. That's less than perfect, but that's what's happening. I would like to see more coordination. I have spoken about it for a long time. At one time in the past, I got kind of hopeful of TV stations working more closely together with Weather Service offices, but it hasn't happened, and so I can't be too optimistic about it right now.
Well, in fact, we talked to Gary England from KWTV a couple weeks back about this very same issue. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on it here, Don.
Yeah. Now, I know Gary well. He and I went to school together
about
40 years ago. So Gary and I are friends, and he's one of the people over time that I have talked to about this. And I know Gary and others at that station and the other Oklahoma City stations are interested in working together, but it's just a difficult nut to crack. Because of the competitive element and because of the fact that the Weather Service has even more security issues now than it used to, you just can't easily pipe data across wide areas anymore.
Well, we know you have to get back to your research, Don. By the way, do you stay so busy that you don't get enough time to cast a few flies?
No, I make sure now that with my retired status that I have time to do that. So I'm already planning my Colorado fishing trips for the summer, and I'm definitely going to take time out to do those.
I am glad to hear that. Thank you so much. Don, it's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed talking to y'all.
Thank you very much, Don.
Don, look forward to talking again, Don, and I appreciate the work you've done with Doppler Radar over the course of the last 30, 40 years. You've been a pioneer in that, and congratulations on your fine work.
Well, thank you, Craig. I've always enjoyed working with you and the good things you've done in Minnesota, and if I can ever have something to contribute and talk to you folks again, I'd be glad to do that.
We will definitely call you up. Thank you so much,
okay.
Don. Bye-bye. That's Don Burgess, a pioneer researcher in radar technology for weather forecasting.
The sky was falling, it streaked with blood. I heard you calling. Then you disappeared into the dust, upstairs, into the fire, upstairs, into the fire.
One of the big stories around the country are the raging wildfires. There's a massive fire burning along the Florida-Georgia border. There are fires burning in California and in Minnesota. In each firefighting effort, has a special meteorologist on board watching the shifting winds and the humidity levels and, of course, potential for rainfall. Does each fire, gentlemen, create its own microclimate? Is that why the meteorologist is on board?
Absolutely, Kathy. In fact, there's been recent research out of Texas, Illinois, and as well as the National Center for Atmospheric Research that the term they use is landscape heterogeneity, but basically it's differences in the surface, basically, a forest versus agriculture. Or a wetland versus an arid landscape, or any number of things, and particularly so with large-scale fires, because the whole radiation balance as well as the flux of moisture from that surface into the overlying boundary layer has effects on local-scale convection. It either can be enhanced or it can be dissipated. And there's a lot of research to show that there are these feedback mechanisms that have a lot to do with the local weather. And I'm sure in some of these cases, the wildfires are having definite effects.
Kathy, we're fortunate in Minnesota. We have one of the premier fire weather forecasters, incident fire weather forecasters, our own Byron Paulson out at the Chanhassen office, deployed across the country for wildfires. He's on the fire up at Ham Lake, been there for a week. He got 50 hours overtime last week, so he's working like 16, 17-hour days. He actually sets up an observation point, sends up weather balloons, gives them forecasts of changing winds. So he keeps the fire weather fighters safe. And so that's a big thing. And I've heard out of this fire at Ham Lake, as large as it is, there's been very minimal injuries. And so part of the purpose for an incident meteorologist is to give them a heads up, a word of position crews, 1,000 people out there, a lot of potential for injuries. So Byron's been out there and he's been on fires for the last 15, 20 years, and he's a good man for the job. And it takes a special breed to live that type of lifestyle and to provide that type of information.
Oh, that is tough. You know, because that area of Minnesota has been so dry, northeastern Minnesota, for about, 3 years, Mark?
It goes back to late 2005,
yeah.
Yes.
Is there something about when you have an ongoing drought, is there something about that that changes? Is there something in the landscape that just kind of perpetuates the drought cycle?
Well, certainly the research of Chagnon and Carl and others recently has highlighted this this effect that drought will persist as a result of the local landscape affecting convection and actually causing, now we get a large fraction of our annual precipitation from convection, from thunderstorm-type rainfall. And if as a thunderstorm complex passes over a landscape that is under a drought situation, it causes that to dissipate, basically. So there is a feedback mechanism that amplifies the drought because it diminishes the number of convective events that you actually derive precipitation from. And I think this has been what's going on in north central and northeastern Minnesota since late 2005, because we've had a lot of delivery of thunderstorm precipitation to the areas west and south of that landscape that's eventually just dissipated by the time it gets to those sections of the state.
Boy, a vicious cycle then.
Well, Kathy, what I've seen in the course of 30 years, and it's a comment we share around the Weather Service office, the drought is broken by a flood. Essentially, what you have to have happen is you have to have an anomalous event comes in that sort of deluges the area, and so you just squash the drought altogether instead of trying to nickel and dime with quarter-inch and half-inch rainfalls. That doesn't get it done, so you need some very heavy rainfall to replenish that area up there. Hopefully, that'll come soon.
Right. That's exactly, Craig, how we recovered, you'll recall, from the 1988 drought. We entered a period of extreme wetness with very, very heavy precipitation events in the early 90s, and that's what recovered all those hydrologic features in terms of lake levels, aquifers, and stream flows.
Okay. Good discussion. Time to move on and wrap this thing up with a website of the week. You know, we should have a drum roll. I don't know. Yeah. Look.
Wow.
She speaks.
Magic.
And there it is. But I'm just kind of wondering, since this is a podcast about the weather, I don't know, do you need a thunder roll or something like that? Jeez, that's not, scared me.
I think I'm feeling drops.
I'm not exactly sure. Well, we'll select one here for next week. But anyway, Mark had a good website recommendation last week on fire conditions. And I'm going to go back to our discussion of last week on cloud watching and suggest this website. vortex.plymouth.edu/cloudboutique. This is from Plymouth State College in Plymouth, New Hampshire. This is the Cloud Boutique website, and I think it's very nice.
It is. Has all kinds of varieties of cloud forms.
And it has a nice video loop, and it has all kinds of fun things on this. And you might want to check it out. So I'm going to give you this address again. vortex.plymouth.edu/cloudboutique. There you go. That's going to do it for us. For another week here at Jet Streaming, feel free to leave a message with us or ask a question. We have a handy feedback form at minnesotapublicradio.org. And in the podcast section, just click on Jet Streaming. Thanks for the feedback, by the way, on Storm Spotters. We're going to talk about those folks on a later show. Mark and Craig, see you later.
Talk to you soon, Kathy.
All right, thanks. I'm Kathy Werzer with much help from Larissa Anderson, our producer. This is Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, keep your eyes on the sky.
Say so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I've got to be drifting along.